Hi, and welcome to the next episode of TransPerfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Farrell Helian. He's founder and principal consultant at OptiTrial, a clinical consultancy technology company. Can we just jump straight in? I mean, we've talked about study design, we've talked about patient centricity forever. Perhaps we could start this off by you talking about how study design is often the missing link and is often overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we get to the study setup side of things, there's a whole lot of work that goes on in the background a year before you're looking at your first patient in, or sometimes even longer than that. And a lot of that is sort of focusing on what do you need to do in the study, and then sort of at the point where there's lots of governance and conversations, sometimes it kind of takes up too much time that you can't really get to. You end up starting to have to rush to the finish line for a first patient in because some of the conversations and decisions may not have really gone as smoothly as possible. And then the critical path, obviously, everyone's perception. The initial critical path is obviously to getting your study protocol finalized and submitted. Then it's getting that first patient in. But ultimately, if you are planning your study out, you need to be focusing on that bigger picture of what's the quickest path to your last patient, last visit, getting your study closed out, which oftentimes you may be rushing to get to the start line and then realize that you're cutting a few corners here and there. You may not be doing the right thing to hit your long-term goals, which can have an impact upon your ability to recruit or retain your patients as well, ultimately, which is one of the big needs of the trials now, is to try and get better at doing that.
You actually touched on this. In my experience, when we get an FPI date, it's often arbitrary. It often comes down, this is our FPI date, and we have to backward engineer from there. And as I said once before, water follows a path of least resistance and flows downhill. So a lot of the time, the providers who are trying to get everything in place, be it the ECOA or an EDC or the IRT, RTMS, doesn't make a difference. They are playing catch-up. And who's ever last on the totem pole, and embarrassingly sometimes it is the language provider, they are playing the biggest catch-up. I mean, why do you think, the long way of asking this question, but why do you think that is the case? Why do they decide arbitrarily, oh yeah, boom, this is the FPI?
I think a lot of times it's just human nature that you need to have something that you're working towards just to avoid where you have an open-ended date, and then that is when things move as slow as they possibly could. But at the same time, that date is, like you said, pretty much arbitrary. Somebody has picked it, put it into a few systems, and everybody's working towards that date until all of a sudden they're not, because the study it's got feedback from the FDA and they now need to push out the timeline by a while. Or consequently, if a site is able to recruit a patient earlier, all of a sudden that can come in by a while, and that puts extra burden and pressure upon everybody in the system as well. So like you said, everybody who's building solutions or preparing for that first patient in, getting all the trainings ready, everything gets squeezed a bit, which, yeah, ultimately, if you're putting timeline pressure, that means that you're going to have to start cutting corners from some of the other areas, which could be needing to reduce some of the quality, or you're putting extra burden upon the resources that are delivering it, which all of the vendors that are part of making studies successful end up having to pick up a lot of slack and often trying to create miracles at the end of the day.
But the other thing is the protocols. There's so many pairs of eyes looking at a protocol from start to finish. And there's so many people have vested interests. They have skin in the game. So that actually wastes so much time. In my experience, it wastes so much time and all these people touching it. And here's my bugbear. Here's my thing. And I wonder how you feel about this. How many times have you seen protocols with so many different measures attached onto it? Do we need all those measures? I suppose is the question.
I often.
What do you advise sponsors?
Probably not. Advice to sponsors is really when you are doing your study design and you're planning your study, take a step back, have a think, okay, what do you actually need to achieve your study objectives? Because the easiest and the most simple way to add more burden to sites, patients, study teams is just by adding more things into your study, which we live in a modern times where you basically have the toy box, you can pick whatever you want and you can probably get data from it now. So it's with all the innovation cycles, there's the land of opportunity that you can get new measures, you can get more frequent data, but ultimately you need to start thinking about, do you actually need it? Do you actually want it? Because in the last 10 years, there's been some research by, I think it was Tufts, that showed that the amount of data in clinical trials has increased by 3 times. And then there's some other articles that I've seen that has said that 30% of the data in a trial just wasn't necessary, which means that you've added a bunch of cost, effort, and burden upon everybody who's involved, the sites, the patients, study teams, which if you didn't need it in the first place and you didn't bother looking at it, you've just, you've wasted a lot of everybody's time and efforts.
And that's always been a thing, a hot spot for me, is that the burden on the patients. And by the way, I'm glad you're using the word patients, because there are certain people that use the word subject, and that does upset me, because these are people, these are human beings already in a compromised disease state, and they're not subjects. But I'm glad that you talk about that. And I think the burden on them with all these added instruments is unfair. But more than that, and you touched on it with the Tufts research, I often wonder how good quality you're getting if you have the patients overburdened. You remember years ago when we used to do IVRS, and there was like this rule of thumb that after 5 questions, the patient loses interest and starts just randomly pressing buttons. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. And same if we overburden them with a number of instruments, we had like a Christmas tree, we tag on these things, we're not going to get great data. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that, when you are doing your design and strategy, there is always going to be things that you need to capture. So there is probably some good reason and science behind wanting to include some of those instruments in the first place. So whether it's eventually you want to make it a primary or secondary endpoint, or it's a safety factor for you. But at the same time, if you do need to include it, also consider how frequently do you actually need to capture that data, because a lot of the burden can come with that. The cadence that you're capturing the data might be unnecessary. So as an example, you get your baseline data and then you want to compare it to a couple of points during the trial. But if you do have a 5-year trial, do you really need to capture a daily diary for every day of 5 years? Because there will be that point in time, like you said, that the patient who's volunteering their time to the study, they're going to start to wane and become less compliant purely because it's just rinse and repeat. And they'll feel that they've got to the point that if they're not reporting something, that I'm just going to do this when I have a problem or a symptom to report, which kind of goes against the point, because if you do need to have the data that proves they didn't have a symptom in that point, you can't really just decide no symptom based on no entry. So it can be counterintuitive to overburden them, and rather than take a more laser-focused and targeted approach to what do you need to evidence your study.
And that goes back to the original argument all those years ago when we said paper is not the perfect solution. Electronic isn't the perfect solution either, but it's a better solution because we don't get this parking lot syndrome thing where patients are filling in data out of memory that they can't remember what they had for dinner 2 days ago, let alone how they felt 5 days ago. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The overtouching of patients, I think, is a big issue. And there's one other point that I want to make around that. A lot of the instruments that you see, a lot of the legacy instruments, the more older ones, when you put them all together, a lot of the same questions are asked. And that really switches patients off. Because they say, hold on, I answered that question in the last one, didn't I? And that really, I think, in a longitudinal study, that alienates patients, I think. I guess, in a way, we've got to talk about what is, I don't know, is there a best practice to come at this? How do we talk to sponsors around, slow your roll there, pal, slow your roll, maybe you don't need that many instruments. How do we get to that?
And I think there is a lot of focus now in the industry in trying to reduce the patient burden as part of this. And I think a funny touch point onto where you do have a lot of instruments that seem to be asking the same thing. Also, there can be some nuanced language that one questionnaire to another might inflict that and switch it over. The patient thinks they're answering the same way, but it might cause the opposite and cause some discordance just because they've ended up feeling that they've answered that question already, like you said. So they go into autopilot and say, yeah, headache, okay, where it could be saying you didn't have any headaches today. In terms of how to be more patient-centric, I think a lot of it is taking a review of what's meaningful to the patient population with that condition that you're researching, really trying to narrow in upon what do they actually need. And then, as well, that we talked about before, focus on what data is critical to proving your study, and then trying to take more adaptive approaches as well. Some approaches that I've seen recently is making use of item libraries or computer adaptive tests rather than putting the patient through the whole questionnaires 5 or 6 times. Try to focus and narrow in on what specific modules that are of interest to your research.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I didn't know we were going to talk about like computer-aided technology. I like that because it's something not talked about an awful lot. The item bank and this newer way of picking and choosing items. I have a couple of things that I'm not happy about, to be honest, or confused, let's say.
Yeah, and I think it's trying to pick out what the concepts that you're trying to extract from that data set, or if, like you were saying, that you're capturing fatigue in a different questionnaire, you might not want to include that in another within the trial, especially where there's a lot of modular questionnaires available, like the ProCTCAE. You may not have an interest of including, I don't know, there's over 100 different variations that you could have if you really wanted to. Yeah. So it's about thinking what's actually important to prove your study needs, but also what's important to your patients, and trying to extrapolate that in the smartest way possible. So if it is being asked in a different place, don't include fatigue 5 times because that's going to tire the patient out as well.
Of course. And lethargy and fatigue is very different to different patient cohorts. Like lethargy to oncology patients is remarkably different to lethargy in depression. You know, it's very subjective. I totally get your point. How does one then choose which items to include and which is it literally disease specific?
I think it is, I would say, disease specific in terms of what would be from your earlier phase research, what are the adverse events that you've picked up on, or what are the key, I suppose, expected side effects that could come up. So you want to make sure that you're focusing upon what is specific to the disease area, but also what you're seeing within your molecule as well that's arise during that early research. So you want to narrow in and make sure that you're capturing the data so that you have enough so that you can put it on your labeling, that it things that have been seen. And I think with the pandemic as well, everybody was reporting different side effects. So that's where you need to have some potential real world evidence studies as well to capture that in the longer term. But for the initial case, you want to be as upfront and transparent with the patients as well.
To that point, so you have this a different bank specific for the particular TA. Is it worthwhile then perhaps doing in-study interviews to actually just take a snapshot, as you rightly say, during the pandemic, a snapshot? Are we capturing what we should be capturing? Are we seeing any signals that we shouldn't be seeing? Is that a useful thing to do? Because there's two schools of thought, just so you know. There's people who believe in this and people who don't believe in this.
And I think it's about finding where is the pragmatic middle between that, because that's one of the reasons that we see so many new data points in studies, because people can capture a lot more exploratory data, which obviously that is trying to understand more about the molecule, more about the impact that it has upon patients. But at the same time, the more that you do add or the more that you try to find out, then that does have the consequence of you're adding extra burden to sites and patients. But like you said, I think when the patients are on site or in discussion with the investigators, that is one of the things that they are meant to try to surface is, have you had any adverse events that have occurred, and they, if you haven't captured it as a diary, then they should be putting that into EDC as well, just to make sure that it's captured. But it's that thing of, like you said, if it's been parking lot syndrome, or you know, they've now waited a couple of weeks after they've had that headache and they get to site and they ask the question, and then are they going to remember, oh, I had a headache 2 weeks ago? So that's one of the challenges as well. Where do you find some balance? And that's where, if or you've seen certain things or you're expecting certain symptoms to arise, to try and capture that as succinctly as possible.
I think one of the challenges I see is that often as not, it's not structured. And you talk about going to the PI's office, you talk about capturing that data almost dynamically. I think it's very difficult for patients to remember the severity of the pain that they had. If we're measuring pain, a headache, or measuring whatever, it's very difficult for them to remember the severity. I'm sure you, in the last year, you probably had some sort of sickness. If I asked you about it now, you'd say, yeah, it was bad, but it wasn't that bad. At the time, you thought, oh my God, I'm really in trouble here. It's funny, we talk about like in obstetrics, we talk about like how mothers remember at the time the pain of birth. And then after a while, it's, oh yeah, it was bad. It was very bad, but it wasn't that bad, because we actually compensate for that. And I think there's a lot of truth for that. That's why I think study interviews are really important, as well as the PI dynamic follow-up. I'm conscious of time, and I read there's something, so much to get through. Can I pivot back to, because I'm curious about this. What I'm hearing is that protocol design from start to finish will tell us our planning, it will tell us our number of instruments, it will tell us our patient cohort, it will tell us all those wonderful things. What I'm hearing, though, an underlying thing is massive flexibility. People like you and who are coming in as white-collar consultants saying, you need to do X, Y, Z. Is that, I'm putting you on the spot, I'm aware of that, but is that a challenge telling, because you came from the sponsor side, is that a challenge telling sponsors, hey, you need to do this?
Yeah, it can be. And that's part of the fun, is that the study protocol and design will tell you what they're looking to capture, but it doesn't go into how you're going to capture it, which is where a lot of that, the areas that you can build flexibility in, or where you can truly focus on patient centricity. Because at the end of the day, if I tell you to build me a house, you could come up with something totally different to what I actually want as well. So it's how to navigate the unknowns when it comes to studies. So figuring out what's that right approach and being more cognizant of everything else that's going on. So when you are trying to do patient-centric implementations, it's not just focusing narrowly on ECOA, but it's looking at all of the things that a patient would have to do as part of their patient journey, and thinking of where things maybe go together, or is there any kind of optimizations or any synergies that you could build in, or how do you minimize the amount of different apps, or how do you build workflow that kind of guides a patient through that journey rather than making them have to remember, I need to do this over here, this here, this here, especially when they're at home, because they don't have the site staff to guide them through like they would if they're in person at a site visit.
Back to your house analogy, and you say, so build me a house. All the bases are there, like walls and roof and all the rest. So is there, can I reuse certain assets in the protocol? Have you seen that?
I think anyone who's been in clinical research has probably, or multiple studies, has come across the fabled copy and paste study. So there's a lot of cases where, just because of the time pressures that we were talking about before, you have to try and find time and efficiencies all across the value chain. So they might take certain elements from protocol A and fit them into protocol B if they're part of same program, same molecule, thinking that it's correct because that's what we did previously, which is obviously oftentimes could be the right case, but there may also be circumstances that it might be prohibitive to do that. So in some of my previous life and experiences, I've come across multiple cases of that, where I think one particular example that stood out for me is that there was a study that was looking, targeting a certain demographic, but the inclusion-exclusion criteria were copied from study A into study B just because they were like, right, that's, it's the same program. And then they didn't really take into consideration some of the physiological elements of that. So the inclusion criteria, I think it had a range for blood pressure, but that was against the target demographic, which meant that they weren't being patient-centric from the start. And they weren't actually thinking about that bigger picture of who am I actually targeting, what data and what people am I looking to work with, which it did get found out and it was adjusted, but that's kind of some of the direct consequences, that the worst side of copy and paste, which hopefully isn't seen too often.
Well, the people like you to advise them to minimize that. I get it. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I've really enjoyed this conversation. I really have. And there's probably more to talk about. But I ask all my guests at the end of the podcast, I always say, if you had a magic wand and you had one wish, what would that wish be?
Great question. So reflecting on the conversation that we've been having, I would say putting a bit of more of a human focus upon the trial design and the scheduled activities that are being asked of patients, and because they are volunteering their time. So when they are putting the study together, I think it'd be great if they think that there is a lot of complexity and studies are getting more and more complex, especially compared to 10 years ago. And like I mentioned, that some of the data is not even being used, but step into that patient's shoes and consider, you know, they've already got the burden of their disease. They're feeling a bit helpless, which is why they're looking to participate in a trial in the first place, because the standard of care mightn't be doing much, or there may not even be a treatment out there for them. So think about the time that they're giving up and what you're asking of them. Just think, if it was you, would you participate in this study as well? And to try and find ways to make it as a smooth experience and a journey as possible for that patient, especially considering everything else that they have to deal with beyond participation.
I like that. I like that a lot. That's true patient centricity. We talk about it a lot, but I really enjoy it. That was great. I like that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Farrell. Today I was joined by Farrell Hillian. He's principal and founder of OptiTrial, a consultancy. Join me next time on that Transperfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade. Thanks a lot. See you soon.